Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. My name is Alexander Starr and I'm the History Project Student Coordinator. Today we're interviewing Jennifer McNaught from the class of 1997. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your first degree is a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology from UBC. Was law at UBC a natural next step for you?
Not exactly. It wasn't what I initially thought I would end up doing. So I was fortunate enough to take a psychology class in high school and immediately fell in love with it and went to UBC very sure about psychology. In fact, I started working in the psychology department as a first year and worked all the way through, and was quite sure I was going to end up pursuing a career in psychology, probably becoming a professor is what I had imagined. And when I was working in the psych department and applying, getting prepared to apply for grad school, I started thinking about grad school and what I wanted to investigate and what I saw myself doing. And I felt a little bit like my life and my educational experiences were somewhat limited in terms of all I knew theoretically and life-wise was what I had just learned in my psychology undergrad. And I felt as though I wanted to bring something unique to my perspective and to my therapeutic approach and to my research. And at that time, there were a lot of issues that were at the intersection between law and psychology. So battered women's syndrome and forensic psychology. And I was quite engaged and interested in those topics. And so for me, law school seemed like just a great thing to add to my school, into my toolkit. I didn't anticipate at that time how much I was going to fall in love with the law and that it was going to sort of send me in somewhat of a different direction.
That's really interesting to think about those intersections. Thinking about just arriving at the law school, do you remember some of your first impressions?
Well, aesthetically, the law school was not that much to look at back in those days.
You're in the Curtis building.
I was in the Curtis building, and no respect, disrespect intended, but it wasn't that attractive a building. It was a bunker. It was like gray and pretty bleak looking. But I remember something that really stood out to me was the inscription on the front of the Curtis building was Fiat Judicia Revit Coelum. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly because my Latin is non-existent. But I remember when I found out what that meant, let justice be done though the heavens fall, I felt sort of humbled by it and I felt like we were doing something important. I felt connected to that.
I guess thinking about more of the inside of the building, do you remember, and what happened there, do you remember specific professors or classmates from your time at school?
Sure. As you know, we just had our 20-year law school reunion.
Yes.
A few months ago. So I got to reconnect with quite a few of my classmates, and that was really fun, really exciting. Allison and James McGinnis are still a couple. They're a family now. They started dating in law school, and they were number one and number two class ranked in our class.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day where we still got ranked. And I think it was pretty close, like point percentages apart, but James was the gold medalist our year, and you know, they're fantastic. And of course, Deb Parks is now on faculty.
Yes.
At Allard Hall, which is great, and several of my classmates are judges now, so Judith Doulis, Reg Harris, and I stay in semi-regular touch with quite a few of my classmates, Andrea Wills, Sarah Picciotto, Jeff Schmetta, Jody Alcorn, Trevor Simpson.
Wow.
So it was just great to have so many of us together. So in terms of professors, there's a few that sort of keep a soft spot for me. One was Professor Tony Hickling. He was my small group teacher, and he taught us contracts, and he made such an impression with one of our first contracts cases, which was Carlile and Carbolic Smoke, that
Mere Puffs.
Right. So as
yes.
My first Halloween, I dressed as a Mere Puff when I was in law school. Professor Barry Slutsky, I'll never forget, he started off the class in a very stoic voice saying, "No abbreviations of my last name will be acceptable." Stephen Wexler, I actually talked to you about him before. He was our torts prof. He was very eccentric, a druid, and he had his office, the floor of his office was covered in dirt, and he sat on a tree stump, and he was very interesting. He opined to the class one day that law school, they give you more reading than you can do to help you develop your judgment and your reasoning and your ability to synthesize information. So, you know, it's teaching a skill as opposed to just teaching teaching how to, what's specifically in a case. And I took something away from that. Brian Higgins wasn't a professor, but he was a supervising lawyer for LSLAP for 23 years. And he had a really large presence at the law school, and he was someone that you could always go to for help and advice, and sort of a fatherly figure that I think a lot of students connected with. The Honorable Stephen Point was the director of the First Nations Law Program when I was there, and I took in my first year legal perspectives with him. And he took us to a sweat lodge and taught us about circle sentencing and restorative justice. And to me, this was just mind-blowing. I mean, it was something that I had never heard of or thought about. It was just such a unique look at the law. And I was quite taken by him and having the privilege of being in his class.
And this was the mid-1990s. So it was that type of circle sentencing and that experience, as they weren't very widespread or well known yet.
It seemed quite unique. And the Honorable Lynn Smith was dean at the time, and I recall her presence as lending a focus on women's issues in the law.
Thinking more about your time in law school, do you remember any extracurricular activities that you had the chance to participate in?
Probably the thing that stands out the most for me was the UBC UVic competitive moot. So I participated in that, and that was really exciting. We mooted the Kronk case, which was an employment law case, and I think that's especially interesting because it must have had a pretty big impact, because that's the law that I ended up practicing. So I was primarily an employment law lawyer, and so, you know, the fact that I had mooted that, you know, I don't know whether that's what led me in that direction, but I certainly think that whole experience was really impactful in law school.
Do you remember the issue that you were arguing over?
Yeah, so the case in general was whether the nature of the employment should impact reasonable notice. It's interesting because I ended up writing articles and case comments for years and years and years on the issue of reasonable notice. So that was certainly my first foray into the issue.
Wow. Other than any competitive moots, was there anything else in your involvement at the school?
I was actually pretty heavily involved with LSLAP when I was in law school. Especially, I got thrown in the deep end in my first year and my first term. I ended up defending two brothers who were charged criminally with a drug charge. And I ended up launching on their behalf a charter defense for an illegal search and seizure. And I hadn't even taken evidence yet, so I remember I was cross-examining a police officer, and I said, he had given an answer, and when I was cross-examining him, I said, isn't it true that you put in your notes XYZ? And the judge was like, Miss McNaught, would you like to enter the police officer's notes into evidence? And I was like, yes, I would. If I knew how to do that, I would be doing that now. So the judges were amazing and very helpful with law students who obviously were helping out without a lot of legal training behind them, to put it mildly. But it was a wonderful experience. I appeared in court quite a bit. I did a fair amount of speaking. I did a speak to sentence, and I did that criminal trial. I was successful in getting the charges dropped, and it was a pretty rewarding experience to be doing something like that when you were a first year law student.
Wow.
And I carried on with LSLAP throughout my time at UBC and worked with Brian Higgins, who I've spoken about before, and he was a really amazing resource program.
I was going to ask, because the LSLAP program now is clinics spread across the city, two supervising lawyers. What was it like when you were in the program?
There were a number of clinics, so I think many of the clinics that exist today also existed then, but at that point, it was Brian who ran the program, as well as there were, of course, volunteering lawyers from lots of different law firms and solo practitioners that came in and helped out, and it was a great way to have the opportunity to see what it was like to work with a client and interview them and research and figure out how to help them. So it was a really amazing experience and a great program.
And then thinking about traditions at the law school, I interviewed another classmate of yours, TJ Dillon.
Okay, yeah.
And he spoke about the salmon barbecue.
I remember the salmon barbecue. It was Ladner Downs at the time, the Friday of the first week of law school. And I still remember lawyers from Ladner Downs flipping barbecues on that day, or, you know, flipping burgers and getting to meet lawyers. So that's where I practiced.
Wow. Yeah.
So that certainly is a tradition I remember as well.
And then, are there any other traditions that you recall?
Well, one thing, our small group had our own little tradition, which wasn't school-wide, but within our group, and we met once a week for breakfast at the King's Head, sort of like a greasy
okay.
spoon study group.
Yeah, is that the one on 10th, just off of campus?
No, it's in Kits on U Street, like so just up from the beach. I actually don't even know if
okay.
it exists anymore. Okay. Yeah, so it was like a very like old school
yeah.
pub, but we would meet there and have breakfast, and it's something that stands out
wow.
for me from law school.
Did developing computer technology change legal education during your time at law school?
Well, when I went to law school, computers were not that prevalent in general. You know, we received case books, so everything was in paper form. Nothing was computerized. We wrote all of our exams by hand. We did all of our research by books. A couple of students maybe had computers, like maybe one or two, but it was certainly very uncommon. And obviously that's changed dramatically now. One thing that I've reflected on as well is the impact that technology has had on recruitment, because there's been a massive change in terms of how much students know about law firms and how much law firms know about students because of technology, especially with respect to students' ability to research and learn about firms. I remember when I was applying to be a summer student, which was in the early to mid-90s, I mean, the internet didn't really exist. I mean, it had officially been created, but it certainly wasn't being used. So unless you had somebody in the industry, a parent who was a lawyer, you just had no way of finding out about the firms. I mean, we had one reception where you would get like a glossy brochure and you'd walk around and talk to people, but that was it. Like, that was all the information you had to make the decisions about what you were going to do and where you were going to go. And if you didn't happen to go to a table, you didn't know anything about them. It's like they didn't exist. So it's a totally different world now in terms of the type of exposure that students have to learn. I think sometimes it's a bit overwhelming because there's so much information. It's almost difficult, I think, for students to narrow it down and know what's important. But we've definitely gone from a total black box where you didn't know anything to, you know, sort of the sky's the limit in terms of how much information you can find out.
Wow. I think it's a good opportunity here to speak a little bit more about recruitment. You have worked in student recruitment for a large portion of your practice, correct?
Yeah, so, well, I practiced for, including summers, for about 6 years, and then I was in-house in sort of a business role for about 4 years, and then did my sojourn back to UBC and working with the Lawyers Assistance Program, and I've been at Blake's in a recruitment education role for over 6 years now, so.
And over sort of those 6 years, I'm sure you've seen it change a little as well. What are some of the recruitment changes? I mean, even comparing when you first started in your first summer and articling, how do you see the differences in recruitment in terms of just meeting people? And I mean, I don't know if you would have looked in a phone book and called someone when you were applying in terms of
yeah.
the on-campus interview process, which is fairly new.
So that didn't exist. So the whole OCI, on-campus interview process, didn't exist when I went through the process. And I think that's actually a very helpful process to give both students and firms the opportunity just to have like a mini meeting. I think also there's way more, certainly with the local schools, there's way more integration between law firms and students now. There's way more events where students get the opportunity to mix and mingle with lawyers from downtown firms that really didn't exist. I mean, I remember, I think probably one of the reasons the Salmon Barbecue sticks out, you know, 20 years later is because of the one of the few times when I was in law school that I actually met a lawyer. The other time was when I mooted. And we were, you know, trained by a firm and met lawyers through that process. But otherwise, the contact between law students and law firms was really minimal, almost non-existent. Whereas now, I think, you know, any law student who was interested in meeting with a law firm would certainly get at least one, if not multiple, opportunities throughout the year to meet with lawyers from that firm. And I think students are a lot more proactive in reaching out to law firms to meet with people to find out information. I think that's facilitated by having someone in a role like mine where it's a lot easier to reach out to someone who is in a recruitment role to say, I'd like to find out more about the firm, you know, can I meet with you, can I have coffee with you? So I think that happens much more regularly now. And I think it is, you know, because most large firms do have somebody in the recruitment role, again, that's something that's very different.
When you when you were applying, it was, so there was like a student committee, but no one really dedicated to finding student talent and bringing it into the firm.
That's right. And I mean, certainly every lawyer who was on the student committee and every lawyer at the firm was dedicated,
yes,
but they didn't have a role specifically set up to facilitate that, and that's certainly changed over the last number of years, that most firms do have someone dedicated to that role.
Do you find your experience in, I mean, you have experience in psychology and then you return for a master's in counseling psychology, do you find that's helped with recruitment or in other areas of the legal profession?
Absolutely. I think the education piece, I mean, part of my degree was actually through the Department of Education. So the education piece and structuring education seminars and things like that certainly comes into play and is helpful in the PDC or the professional development piece.
So we've spoken that you have been involved with the school in terms of working in recruitment and getting to meet students. Are there other ways you've stayed involved with the law school at UBC since your graduation?
When I was with the Lawyers Assistance Program, I started coming out to speak sort of during first year orientation on paths taken, because I think I had taken a bit of a unique path with my own legal career. And I also liaised with the CSO office in terms of giving support to students who needed some extra support while they were going through school through the Lawyers Assistance Program, so that was really rewarding.
Could you just sort of expand a little? For those who are unfamiliar with the Lawyer Assistance Program, it covers a wide variety of it has a variety of goals.
Right.
Yeah.
It's set up and sponsored. Lawyers support it through the Law Society, but it's at arm's reach from the Law Society. So it's an organization that's created to help lawyers in distress. And it initially started with a focus on addictions, and so it was there to support lawyers who were struggling with various forms of addictions. Over the last number of years, it's expanded in to help lawyers with numerous different issues or challenges they may face, whether that's, you know, stress, anxiety, marital problems, career questions, those types of things. And so I worked as a counselor and support person in the Lawyers Assistance Program for a number of years, and through that help students and lawyers.
And with your experience in that program, do you find that the broadening in terms of assisting lawyers with things beyond just addiction has sort of had the effect of almost like preventing some of the more addictive behavior or more addiction related behavior?
I'd like to think so. I certainly don't have any hard evidence
on
that, but I do think that sometimes stress can lead to escapist behavior, such as drinking or some form of addiction. So the fact that the Lawyers Assistance Program provides support and encouragement and referrals to different agencies that can assist, I think, is certainly a positive thing for the profession.
Interesting. You also mentioned the helping out with the Career Services Office, and I think UBC, rightly so, likes to brag that it's one of the best Career Services Offices in the country, probably in part due to the assistance from practicing lawyers who come in and help at the school. How have you seen the Career Services Office change?
The whole development of the Career Service Office is new. So, I mean, I think back when I went to school, I think Brian Higgins was probably the closest thing to a Career Services Office that we had in terms of, we'd go ask him questions like, what do you think of this firm and what do you know about that? Just because he was the most connected to the legal community than anyone that I knew. But obviously the UBC Allard Hall has this amazing Career Services Office. I think it's the gold standard, frankly, of Career Services offices with the kind of support and training that they put into preparing students. And I think that's been a major change in development since I went to law school, is having that resource for students, having people that are dedicated to supporting students and helping them understand the transition from law school to the legal community, helping them prepare resumes, working with people such as myself to do mock interviews and to have panels that give them tips on how to be successful. And I really see Allard Hall students coming into social situations being very prepared and very professional and really understanding how to take the most advantage of those types of situations. I mean, I think a lot of things have stayed the same with respect to the law school. The reputation is similar. It's still considered to be excellent. Obviously, the biggest change is the school itself. The new building is spectacular. I mean,
it's amazing. And just the views down towards.
Yeah, when we were at our reunion and we were on the terrace lounge and we were just looking out, I was just thinking, wow, what an amazing place to have the privilege of studying. I mean,
I love it. I don't want to leave that building.
And I mean, I think reputationally, it's continued to thrive and is a great school.
As someone heavily involved with professional development through coaching and counseling lawyers, what skills do you see as necessary to the profession?
Well, I mean, I think that there's certain skills that are common amongst all professionals, you know, driven, focused, hardworking, dedicated, smart. These are sort of the traditional IQ-based skills. What I've seen really develop and come into focus in more recent time are more of the EQ issues that recognize that law is a client service industry and the business of law. And we see more and more the people that are very successful obviously come with the IQ piece, but really are able to focus on and show maturity in the EQ traits as well. You know, we look at things like, you know, the self-awareness that comes out as developed in confidence and a sense of humor. We look at self-regulation, so impulse control. So we see people that are trustworthy and conscientious and adaptable, internal motivation, so achievement, commitment, optimism, empathy, being able to understand and relate to others, take a very client-centric approach, and people with really highly developed social skills so that they can get cues from the environment on how to establish common ground with people and develop that rapport and that bond. And these are the skills that we really see having people thrive at an early stage in their careers. You know, I think that we really see people in this profession that are amazingly kind and trustworthy and loyal and philanthropic and...
Yeah. People who work hard and find time still to have that balance of volunteering or interest. I mean, you still ski, I'm sure.
It's been a while, but my oldest son just made the Tai ski racing team at Grouse Mountain. So
awesome.
This year we're buying a family pass and we're getting, the little one is 3, so we're introducing him to the slopes.
So exciting. And then I'm sure that you, I mean, as a mother, that's already a whole bunch of time in terms of volunteering and that kind of stuff. And there's other, I mean, do you have other?
Right now, just you know, I volunteer on the PAC for our executive, for my son's school, and there's lots of extracurricular things, but there's lots of things in the community. I volunteered to serve lunch at Harbor Lights is something we do as a firm, and so certainly every opportunity I get is, you know, I try to give back to the community.
Excellent. Yeah, you say philanthropic, lawyers are philanthropic people, and it is. It's important to be leaders in giving back as well, I think. Have you mentored or met any memorable students or lawyers during your career?
Well, certainly many, but one person that stands out to me, and it wasn't necessarily a mentor, but it was just one of those, like, those moments where my legal education and my real life sort of came together in a pretty amazing way. I had just started at Blake's, and I was asked to introduce one of the panelists that was going to be speaking at our firm retreat. And I said, yes, of course. And they said, okay, it's one of our partner emeritus, Marvin Storo. And I said, I'd be happy to do that. And then I started researching him and was completely blown away by his career and his achievements. And I don't know whether you interviewed him. He is one of the interviews for this history project. But I mean, he's an absolute legend. He appeared as counsel of record at the Supreme Court of Canada 24 times.
Wow.
He's argued some of the most important cases in the 20th century, especially with respect to Aboriginal land claims and law. He argued Guerin, Sparrow, Dalgamuk, and he took these cases when, you know, it wasn't necessarily a popular position to take, as we were talking about earlier, in terms of how prevalent these ideas were at the time. And he's been ranked by Canadian legal scholars as being among the top 15 most important cases in Canadian history, several of his cases that he's argued.
So you had to introduce him.
Yeah, so I had to introduce him and interview him and talk to him, and I was completely humbled by him. And I mean, and he's just the kindest man. Like, he's the sweetest, most approachable, sincere, kind person. And it was just one of those moments where I was just completely, you know, I was completely in awe of him and what he had accomplished in his career. I mean, I think I read in the Advocate article that at one point he was doing almost 10% of all the pro bono work done in BC.
Wow.
He was doing it. And he's also an amazing athlete, and he was described by one of our partners as cutting a tennis ball as easily as most people cut cake. And there's a funny story about one of our associates, you know, who's a partner now, like challenging him to a tennis match and then getting completely annihilated by him in front of the whole firm. And I mean, he's just quite a character and somebody that I am in awe of.
I think in the legal profession, and I found especially doing this job, there's a lot of people that you can meet who have these amazing career histories, and it's almost intimidating. I don't know. How have you found it in terms of being able to be there and really like approach these amazing people at sort of the peak of their careers?
I think you'd be surprised how approachable most of them actually are. You know, I have been amazed. I mean, we're having Peter Hogg come and speak to our office on an issue of minority government, and I've been dealing with him, and he's, again, just the most approachable, kindest, polite person, and I really think these are the people that are so successful, these are people that are pursuing their passion and doing something they love and become so great, but I certainly think they all remain very approachable people that are often more than happy to be a mentor to younger lawyers coming up.
You obtained your master's degree from UBC in 2009 in counseling psychology, also done through the Faculty of Education. How have you found this impacting your career?
I think as a starting point, it helped me focus what I wanted to do. I knew that I loved the law. I knew I loved the legal community. I knew I loved psychology. And it sort of gave me the educational foundation and the practical tools to sort of put all of these interests together. When I was in grad school, I focused on issues that were relevant to lawyers and prevalent issues in the community, and I sort of had that as my focus when I went through, so that when I started counseling, it was something that I could use. And one thing I just think as an example is, I counseled many women who sort of came to me because they made the decision that they wanted to leave private practice. And this is a common problem in the legal profession. I think it's certainly getting better. We've seen changes, but certainly as I grew up as a lawyer, women leaving, the attrition rate for women leaving was very, very high. And when I spoke in depth with people, these women, about why they'd made the decision, you know, I discovered that a lot of times it was internal pressures. So these are women that have been accustomed to being exceptional, super high performers, doing, you know, everything that could be done, and then some, always saying yes, you know, feeling great because they're achieving, in their eyes, what they wanted to be achieving from a career perspective. And then you have a child, and it's a curveball. I mean, it's one of the most amazing things you're ever going to do, but it's a whole new level of responsibilities and commitments, and you're exhausted, and you know, all of these things. And all of us, you know, these women would describe to me feelings of inadequacy, because they'd gone from feeling like they were killing it to feeling like they were failing, you know, failing as mothers, failing as wives, failing as lawyers. And the cognitive dissonance that created was so severe that the answer for many women that I interacted with was to take a job that they perceived that they could do well with less time and energy. So they, you know, in essence, pulled out of the game so that they could stop feeling that way. And so what I tried to do was work with them to change their own expectations of themselves, to help them recognize that they were still being amazingly successful, and that they just needed to sometimes moderate their own internal dialogue, is to not be so critical, because often the criticism wasn't coming externally. It was their own internal voice telling them that they weren't doing enough.
This is a little bit of a more, I'd say, challenging question, but which accomplishments in your career so far are you most proud of?
I think probably what I'm most proud of is charting my own path, and putting together each of my experiences to create what for me is a job that is completely in alignment with my core values. I am somebody that truly loves what I do and am excited to come to work every day. And for me, that's been a real journey. I mean, it involved me leaving psychology when that was where I totally thought I was going to go. Leaving the private practice of law, notwithstanding that I was really happy and loved being a lawyer and loved the work that I was doing. Then leaving being in business with my family to go back to school. And then eventually leaving the Lawyers Assistance Program to come here. And so there were a lot of unknowns. There were a lot of sort of steps into the void that that were challenging at the time. But it reminds me about an article that I was writing when I started at the Lawyers Assistance Program. And at that time, there was a book called The Last Lecture, written by Randy Pausch. And it came out of
He had cancer, he was going to give one last lecture.
He was going to give a last speech. Now, at the time, they asked top professors around all the universities to come and give graduation speeches, assuming if you had a kernel of advice to impart to the next generation, what would it be? Now, between when he agreed to give the speech and when he actually gave the speech, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So the speech actually became the life kernels that he wanted to pass on, not only to students, but to his own children. And he talked in that book about reliving, you know, questioning your life and figuring out whether you're really living your childhood dreams. And if you're doing what you thought you were going to do, and how in alignment you are with it, and that to accept challenges not as brick walls, but as an indication of how bad you want something. And you know, I look at my life and my career and realizing that each step, it was just a step towards getting exactly what I want out of my life and out of my career. One of his quotes was, experience is what you get when you didn't get exactly what you wanted. And often that's the most valuable thing we have. And each thing that I've done in my life, I've gained such amazing insight and perspective and experience that it's helped me get to the next level. And it's helped me now be in this role that is so exciting and so rewarding. And the ability to be with students and spend time with them and first year associates and see their excitement and their enthusiasm and to help them thrive in their careers is, to me, the most rewarding career I can imagine. I think about the quote of Albert Einstein, and he says, try not to become a person of success, but rather become a person of value. And I feel like what I do, I hope, adds value. And that, to me, is the most meaningful thing I could do.
It's great to hear sort of how this advice has influenced your own perspective on your career. Do you have advice you would pass on to students who may be listening to this interview?
I do. My advice would be, when you start practicing, figure out what's important to you and block time to ensure that you do these things with enough frequency to feel fulfilled. And maybe it's going to the gym 3 times a week. Maybe it's walking your kid to school every other Friday. Maybe it's volunteering for a class field trip once a term. Work can easily become all-consuming, and you need to keep your personal values in focus. And it reminds me of a story. I was listening to a lecturer once, and he told the story, and he said, my wife and I had 2 kids. She was a stay-at-home mom. She was always there. She picked the kids up from school. She did all that. And when our oldest son went on an overnight field trip, she went with them. So for once, I had to pick my younger son up from school. So one day, I left the office at 2:30 in time to pick him up from school. And I picked him up at school, and it was a beautiful day, and we went to the park, and we played in the park. And we went to a pizza joint, and we sat down, and we had some pizza, and he told me about his day. We went home, and I gave him a bath and put him in his Spider-Man pajamas, and I read him a chapter out of James and the Giant Peach and kissed him goodnight. And when I was walking out of his room, he said, Dad, this has been the best day of my life. And you realize that it's not hard to do, right? He could do that once a month and change the dynamic of his family relationships and of his own personal satisfaction. I mean, he told that story saying, that felt so good for me. And you realize it's not at all hard to do. You schedule like an appointment in your book. It's not quantity, it's quality. So if one day a month, you say, this is what I'm gonna do, and then you make it happen. You have to be intentional about it, and you won't regret it if you do that. And so be intentional about doing the things that matter to you. Maybe it's dinner with your sister, maybe it's, you know, whatever, it's an activity or an exercise. You have to be intentional about scheduling those things, and that will make a difference in the longevity of your happiness in the career.
Is there anything else you'd like to share before we conclude?
Overall, I think law is a great profession, and Allard Hall is an amazing school. I feel very privileged for having gone there, and I feel very lucky to be still involved in it today, especially with my exposure to the students, and I appreciate you taking the time to interview me.
We're very lucky to still have you involved with the school. Thank you for participating.